If you're curious to engage with a lot of the topics we explore on the podcast in more creative and embodied ways, we welcome you to join us in Alchemize, our 10-week audio-based program of daily imagination practices intended to disrupt status quo ways of thinking, sensing, relating, and being. To be honest, without any grant support for our show right now, and we did just get turned down by several mainstream environmentalism philanthropies, this program and our Patreon are our primary means of supporting our labor for these free podcasts right now. We really want to remain untethered to corporate interests, and every small contribution to our Patreon or enrollment in our program Alchemize helps to ensure that we can continue producing these vital conversations that feature voices and perspectives often sidelined from mainstream media. So if you value our work and want to dive deeper with us, join us in Alchemize today at greendreamer.com/alchemize and join our Patreon starting at just $3 at patreon.com/greendreamer. Thank you so, so much for however you are able to support our work during these critical times. We are so deeply grateful.
When we begin to know what we want help with, we also begin to know what other beings want. And what other beings want is not so different from what we really want, which is, you know, people want healing and love and collaboration and joy and connection and intimacy and grandchildren. And they want the world to thrive and bloom. What is it like to begin to collaborate with that world again?
You're listening to Green Dreamer, and I'm your host, Kamea Shane. Today, we welcome Perdita Finn, the co-founder, with her husband, Clark Strand, of the Pharaoh Fellowship of the Way of the Rose, which inspired their book, The Way of the Rose, The Radical Path of the Divine Feminine Hidden in the Rosary. Perdita now teaches popular workshops on getting to know the dead, where participants are empowered to activate the miracles in their own lives with the help of their ancestors and recover their own intuitive magic. Her book, Take Back the Magic, Conversations with the Unseen World, is an intimate journey through her discovery of these lost ways.
As modern people, we treat death like it's somehow an accident or a mistake. And everything dies, you know. Every living thing dies, and every animal and every plant. Mountains die, rivers die, continents die, planets die, stars die, universes die, and everything sleeps. But everything wakes up again, too. And when we're living in relationship to the natural world, I often say that I'm a practitioner of ecology, not theology. We know that the moon waxes and wanes. We know that the sun sets and rises again. We know the seasons turn. And we know that all of nature turns in vast cycles all around us. And that the understanding that birth and death, rebirth, to live inside those vast cycles of comings and goings and reunions is to have a very, very different relationship to dying and death. I sometimes say to my children, you know, I hope I live a long time. I hope I get to hold a great grandbaby in my arms one day. And, you know, that's my prayer. But I don't know what this story, how it's going to unfold. And I always say to my children, you know, if I take off, it's because there's more I can do for you on the other side than I can do on this side right now. And yet I also want those I leave behind to know what my prayers are for my next life, that my life isn't over. My collaborations with my loved ones are not over. They're going to unfold in a different way, and I'll be returning. My prayer is that when I am reborn, my parents next time around are going to know who I am. Not just know who I am in terms of, you know, my affinities and fears, but know me as Perdita. I want to hit the ground running. You know, and I think that we used to live like that. I think in the wonderful, wonderful book, Sand Talk, by Tyson Yunkaporta wrote, he talks about what it means to live inside a culture where your great-grandmother is also your child. It completely transforms the way you treat your elders, and it completely transforms the way you treat your children. And so I think the reason I'm talking about these great cycles is when we really live inside circles instead of straight stories that begin with Genesis and end with Apocalypse, that imagine we only have one life to get it right and only one human life matters. When we let go of that merciless finality of the short story, it transforms our relationship to everything. It transforms our relationship to birth. We know our elders, you know, an extraordinary man I knew until he was 70, you know, I've met him as a four-year-old child. He is now a child who's also my elder. We are all each other's mothers. We're all each other's children. So much changes. And our relationship to death changes drastically. You know, it doesn't have to be a failure. And we're continuing in a different way. So, you know, I often ask people, what is the prayer that you want the people at your funeral to hold for you for your next life? What if we could imagine that the story wasn't over, but the story was continuing? I think everything would change. And, you know, this isn't about, you know, death practices, about where we bury the dead or how we bury them. I think we'd also change that too. I think we were very frightened of the bodies of the dead. You know, I had a terrible experience this past week in which a deer died in my yard. Unexpectedly, abruptly, a young mother deer, I'd known her all winter, and she got trapped in my garden and got panicked in the fenced in garden and threw herself against the gate instead of walking through it. And broke her neck. And some guys arrived to work on my house and they saw her there and they said, is it okay if we take her to eat her? And I'd been feeding her all year. I said, yeah, you can take her. I don't understand the mystery of it, but she had come to feed them. I had fed her and now she was feeding them and we all feed each other. And I hope one day, you know, my prayer would be that my body could be laying out in the woods to be food for the coyotes and the vultures and the mice and the beetles and the worms. We've forgotten that we who eat must be eaten. I think when people used to call themselves the salmon people or the reindeer people or the buffalo people, it wasn't just this is what we eat or this is what we feel an affinity for. We knew that we died and were reborn as the salmon or the deer or the buffalo that would feed our kin. And our kin knew that when they ate that food, they were eating their ancestors. And that transforms our entire relationship to death, to life, to eating. And most of all, it transforms our relationship to love, I think.
I mean, our worldviews very much also impact policy, because I feel like there are different parts of the world where there are even legality issues to people being able to make their bodies quote unquote edible or really edible to whoever they want to, you know, gift their bodies to after passing. All of this really speaks to the power of cultural narratives and our worldviews and how we relate to the world. And I also wonder if it's not so much that a lot of us have lost our engagement with the dead around us, but more so that we've lost a sense of relationship with the dead around us, as in inevitably death is all around us. You know, this wood that my chair was made of, the fibers of my clothes, and so on. So instead of the bodies of my dead kin or beings that I have a relation with becoming something that I then see as a gift or offering into my life, there are a lot of bodies of beings around me that I have no relation with. So I wonder if it's kind of like the idea of interdependence or intradependence, in that it's there and ever present, But part of the problem has become that a lot of people in cultures of individualism start to not be able to recognize that interdependence, and that worldview of dissociation then shapes their decisions and behaviors accordingly. In the sense of death, it's not so much that a lot of people have lost engagements with the dead because it's inevitable, but more so a sense of dissociation and this urge to invisibilize or do away with and not see them. And then, of course, that might then also impact our decisions and, you know, policymaking and behaviors and worldviews.
We're very lonely and we're very scared. And that's kind of what it means to be a modern civilized person. You know, we're the species that traumatizes itself. And we feel alone. You know, look at, we put babies alone in cribs and rooms by themselves to cry it out. You know, what animals do that? Babies cry and they want to learn that someone answers their cries. You know, babies should be close to their mothers to have their heartbeats regulated. And so even from the moment of birth, we are encouraging isolation. But one of the things I found that's transformative for people, and this just happened to a student of mine, I work with a lot of people, I teach a lot of classes to try and help make this all real for people. Not an ideology, not a belief system, not some abstraction in our heads, but a really fundamentally simple and lived experience of rootedness and entanglement. And the way that I teach people to do that is, one is to collect their dead, to know the names of the dead and to know the names of the living, to know the names of the birds and the trees and the weeds where you live, and also to know the names, collect all your dead. And I talk about the dead, not just ancestors, but like friends and neighbors and pets and animals. When I include my dead, it includes the hemlock tree I used to play under as a child near the library. It includes the woodchuck I found dead by the side of the road. It includes all beings whose deaths have come to me in one way or another. And then in order to feel their reality, what I discovered that when we ask the dead for help, not general help, not sort of abstract help, but really specific, concrete help in our lives, we can begin to experience the dead as actually present and available to us. You know, I had a student for whom this happened this week. She didn't know how to make sense of this. I had given her the assignment, just ask for help with something silly and practical, but naughty in your life, something you have not been able to solve, and ask someone on the other side for help. And she couldn't think of what to ask for because we're trained not to ask. And finally, she realized she had some problem with her house and she hadn't been able to find anyone to help her fix this carpentry problem in her house. For whatever reason, she couldn't find a carpenter, couldn't find a handyman. Everyone she called was busy or too expensive. And finally, she put her grandfather on it. She said, "Granddaddy, help me fix my house." And within an hour, a friend of hers had called her with the name of a handyman out of the blue. And within 2 hours, he was there and the problem was solved for almost nothing. And what had happened was she realized her grandfather was real. And when her grandfather became real, all of the dead became real for her. And she began sobbing. And when the dead become real, the living become real. The trees are there to collaborate with us. The flowers are there to collaborate with us. Everything wants to collaborate with us. But we have to listen and we have to ask for help. And we also have to know we need help and that we're worthy of help. And when the world becomes real again and the dead become real again, I think everything changes and fear begins to vanish. I begin my morning fretting and worrying. I'm a great worrier. And, you know, I have children and pets and animals and friends and, you know, I worry about everything. And I articulate those worries and to each worry, I give it to someone or sometimes a team on the other side. And I begin my morning with assignments and connections and intimacy, chatting with everybody on the other side. And I end up stepping into my day without anxiety and also without fear. And the thing that the dead will bring you is a really unshakable foundation of faith. So we can become an oasis of faith in these times of fear. if you go outside and you touch the dirt, wherever you are, I don't care where you are, if you're in the city, go touch the dirt near some tree planted into the sidewalk. Touch the dirt. And that dirt is made up of the bodies of the dead, dead insects, dead stones, dead ocean creatures who made those stones, dead birds, dead beings, dead plants. And all of those dead are real, and they all want to collaborate with us. They want to help us with those green dreams of the planet. When we begin to know what we want help with, we also begin to know what other beings want. And what other beings want is not so different from what we really want, which is, you know, people want healing and love and collaboration and joy and connection and intimacy and grandchildren. And they want the world to thrive and bloom. What is it like to begin to collaborate with that world again? That's a little far from policy. I don't know, you know, I'm not sure policy is going to save us, but I think the dead will.
Yeah. And it's all connected ultimately. You've named before that we have been in the age of enlightenment since the 18th century, and we've become addicted to light, clarity, and information. What does it mean to step into the darkness that's filled with mothers who've loved us from lives we can't even remember, who even now are reaching out to hold us, end quote. I am curious to hear you elaborate on our addiction to light, clarity, and information, because I feel like so much is encompassed in this framing. And yeah, also just how does this relate to our socio-ecological spiritual crisis?
Full disclosure, my husband wrote a book about all this called Waking Up to the Dark, which is about our addiction to light. You know, civilization is defined by its addictions. And it's perhaps one of its worst addictions has been its addiction to artificial light, not sunlight, but artificial light. And that addiction has fueled our sense of primacy and progress. One of the things that's fascinating to me about, quote, the Enlightenment is what it emerges out of and what has to happen before it can fully come into being. And what had to happen was that women had to be murdered all across Europe. I mean, one of the fascinating things about the European gynocide is it didn't happen in the Middle Ages or the Renaissance. It happened in the modern era. It happened from the 1500s to the 1700s. It happened on the eve of what we call the modern world. And it didn't happen, quote, in backwards places. It happened in the seats of education. It happened in the most educated areas of Germany, France, and Scotland, and England. The places with the best universities committed the worst atrocities against women. And the thing they most often accused women of doing was speaking to the dead. And that is really fascinating to me, more than midwifery, more than talking to plants or talking to animals. It was talking to the dead that could have you sexually tortured and murdered. And that great silencing, of course, doesn't really end. It just goes, gets transferred to the Americas and gets enacted upon the bodies of, you know, Black and Brown and Indigenous peoples here. But the modern world is built on that silencing of women and the dead and the dark. And we become fixated on information and our own intellectual power. I think, therefore I am, says Descartes, right? Just before he cuts out the vocal cords of animals he's going to dissect. And Harvard, that great seat of enlightenment, you know, it's the good men of Harvard who commit the atrocities in Salem. It's not teenage girls. It's educated men. And enlightenment has become this fantasy that we can live in our heads instead of our bodies, that somehow our bodies are bad, and particularly women's bodies are bad, and the bodies of brown and indigenous people are bad, and dark places are bad, wombs are bad. I am always correcting people to say darkness, you know, you don't sleep well if you sleep in the light. We torture people by leaving the lights always on. And so many of our problems and issues come from light, which disrupts our hormones, disrupts our sleep, disrupts our dreams, disrupts our intuitions, disrupts our lives. You know, everything grows in the dark. Babies gestate in their mother's wombs in the dark. Seeds grow in the dark of the earth. We can only see the stars at night in the dark. And we've so banished darkness, been so frightened of it, and it's so intertangled with our fear of the unseen world and our fear of women and women's bodies that it's just hard to know how we get through it. I mean, people are always talking, you know, walk towards the light, you know. I would say, well, what about walking in the dark? My husband and I love to walk in the dark. We often go walking at night. The thing I love about walking in the dark is you really have to feel your feet. You have to feel the earth beneath you. You know, much of our fear of the dark is our fear of human beings in, you know, in cities, in civilized places in the dark and the terrible things they do to each other. It's not our fear of the dark out in the woods, you know, out in the woods in the dark, you know, it's pretty lovely. I once bumped into a bear, you know, we kind of startled each other, but then we were all okay with it, you know.
Yeah, I've personally been very fascinated by darkness and reframing narratives around darkness. And I was reading about dark adaptation and how even researchers are now looking into how spending time in total complete darkness or just darker spaces in general, it activates our different senses and also gets people to be less afraid of uncertainty and the unknowns. Because it forces you to engage your bodies and receive and register the world in different ways, in ways that are kind of suppressed by our more mainstream ways of living. Yeah, just, you know, towards sunset, turning on all the lights and never really, you know, experiencing darkness until it's time to turn the lights off to sleep. But what would it be like to engage with darkness more, not just during sleep, as a passive way of engaging with darkness, but like when we're awake and, you know, just experiencing the world in darkness. So this all really resonates with me.
You should come to our house because, you know, people are always sort of astounded, like, you know, we don't fix lights when they break in our house, you know what I mean? Like, you know, the other thing is it changes your relationship to the sun. Mm-hmm. Because when you live in darkness and for most of the time of this planet, we've lived in darkness. We've learned your relationship to the moon and the stars and the sun is so different, right? You really feel in relationship to them. And that sunrise in the morning feels so beautiful and so delicious. And yet deep darkness, we've also lost, because we've lost darkness and we've so privileged clarity and vision, we think we can know everything. It's part of our human supremacy, isn't it? That we don't live inside the mystery anymore. I like to live in the mystery, the great, what I call the great I don't know. You know, if you think about it, most of what happened to our souls before we were born into this life is a great I don't know. Most of what will happen around us is a great I don't know. We sit on a planet inside a galaxy, most of which we don't know. Most of the cosmos is dark matter. 80% of the cosmos is dark matter, and we don't know what it is, you know? And there's something about, I try to encourage people, if you want a mantra, how about I don't know? And what is it like to say, I don't know, but I can feel my feet on the ground, and I trust my feet to find their way to the next step. And I can trust touch again. And, you know, we live inside this disembodied pornographic culture, and it's certainly not making us feel happy or kind to each other. The lights are going to go out. You know, we know that, right? They're going to go out. I have every faith in it. Will we know how to see in the dark when that happens? And will we trust the dark when it arrives? It always arrives. The sun always sets.
You're listening to Green Dreamer, an alternative podcast made possible by listeners like you. To support our community-powered show and listen to our disruption-free, extended, and bonus episodes, join us today on Patreon at patreon.com/greendreamer. Engaging with your work has really reminded me of our past conversation with Dr. Vanessa Andreotti when she talked about needing to sit with our shits. And when I look at our present times and dominant cultures, there does seem to be a sort of urge to bypass or repel these things like decay, decomposition, the dead, and the dark. And I lived with a composting toilet for 2 years, having to haul around and deal with and compost my own waste. And I do want to get back to having that setup because even though it wasn't the most pleasant or convenient thing, I think having to engage with the process of compost, whether my waste or rotting food compost, or having to engage with darker spaces at night with limiting electricity, or having to sit with and engage with dead plants and animals. I can't even describe it or put it into words, but I think all of this discomfort that a lot of mainstream society tries to do away with, I think it really does something to the human consciousness or sense of relation and responsiveness to the world. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what impacts it might have for people to bypass these messes and often unseen yet integral parts of life. And more broadly speaking, what you might have to share in regards to a mainstream society that seems to be death phobic or being scared of or uncomfortable with the dark, the dead, the decay, and all the shits.
My husband and I say we write about the dark, the dirt, and the dead, you know, and I always say, I don't want to leave anything out. You know, the mess, I want to embrace the holy mess. The mess is where things grow, right? There's this corner up, you know, near where the town where I live, that there used to be a gas station, you know, and like many former gas stations that left, you know, a polluted, toxic area, nobody wants to grow anything. So it's just a lot of broken cement and graffiti. But there are all these plants have moved in, you know, ailanthus and chicory and dandelion. And they look at this mess and they say, okay, what are we going to make? What are we going to do here? You know, what are we going to grow? Let's get going, gang. And how do we play with mess? You know, nature is messy. Nature's not pure. Nothing grows from purity. And civilization has been obsessed with purity from the get-go, right? Because purity is about control. And it's about that, you know, the body is so messy. And usually it's women bodies that are the most messy, right? I mean, one of the things I've been doing a lot of research on lately is when human beings first begin to create art, it's clear that that first art comes when women, when they're menstruating together, they'd separate themselves from the community. They'd all be menstruating at the same time. And they'd take themselves away from the community so they wouldn't attract, you know, animals and with their blood. And we find the first art is, you know, those wonderful ochre handprints and the tectiforms of dots. You know, the male scientists coming in couldn't figure out why there were all these 28 dots on the walls of the caves. You know? And they were surprised to discover that the handprints were mostly women's hands. We treat menstrual blood like it's the worst waste of all, right? It's an unmentionable. And it was our first artistic substance. We knew that it wasn't making babies, so let's make a world with it. And we took it and we painted our bodies and we painted the cave walls and we began to paint worlds into being. We made magic happen with that blood. It seems like when did they stop using menstrual blood and start to use ochre, you know, stone ochre? Vultures will paint their eggs with ochre, that's red clay, to camouflage them. And so I suspect that watching the vultures, those who be, you know, very symbolic, one of the oldest symbols of that kind of Kali goddess energy, creator, destroyer, they began also mixing their blood with red ochre to create cave art around the world. So the messiest substance, the substance that's considered the most impure, is where we learn to make things from. I am obsessed with the horrors of our penal system and of what we do to prisoners to torture them and, you know, putting them into solitary confinement. One, with the lights always on, which drives people mad. It's the worst torture. And then the other is that there is no nature, right? And frequently when people put in that situation, they'll say, oh, they took their feces and smeared them across the wall, as if somehow that justifies torturing these people this way because they're sort of barbaric or monstrous. But I've sometimes thought, you know, I have this idea like, no, they're trying to make life happen. They're trying to make dirt happen. They're trying to make something grow in this awful, sterile environment. Their reaction to the horror and the torture is to try to figure out, how can I make dirt to make something grow here where nothing is growing? So I am very pro shit and pro blood and pro mess and pro growth, pro compost.
The title of your book is Take Back the Magic, and that can sound abstract for people just coming across it. And in many ways, perhaps it is an invitation to tune into our less nameable or less intellectualizable ways of knowing and being, something that really honors our intuitive and spiritual senses. But what does magic mean to you, and how might it offer us guidance or remembrance, especially during these troubled and difficult times?
Well, magic to me is completely organic and completely natural. We think of magic as technological, right? It's going to be something, it's going to be, you know, some 3D techno exciting thing out of, you know, wizardry that happens. You know, our communications are magic, our airplanes and our transportation are magic, our healthcare is magic. Truth is that we have forgotten what real magic is. You know, I'm so fascinated by the fact that placebos work something like 50% of the time, and yet we don't study them. That's magic, right? Sugar pills work. My father was a country doctor, and he used to keep sugar pills because they worked. He would say to someone, you know, this was in the old days, the pre-bureaucratized days. He'd take them out to someone who something nothing he could do anything for and say, well, you know, I've got these drugs. I shouldn't give them to you, but I'm just going to, you know. There was a lot of theater involved, right? And a lot of trust building. We had real relationships with these people. And he'd pass them the sugar pills, and 2 weeks later, they'd come and say, Doc, those were amazing. I'm all better. And they would be all better. Eventually, the communication systems are going to fail. The technology is going to fail. There aren't going to be airplanes and cars. And the drugs are already failing. And we'll need to remember the old ways of collaborating with the plants, collaborating with the unseen world to make magic happen. I see magic and miracles happen with people every single day. People write me. They say, oh, this works. I would say, bring me your miracle. When you bring me your miracle, you know what I'm talking about. Bring me the knot you thought was untiable and offer it up to the dead and see what happens. Or it might be something as simple as, I don't think I can solve this problem. Offer it to the dead. See what happens. And then tell me whether or not magic is real. Don't believe me. Try it out.
Perhaps this is part of the problem, but I find it difficult to see people at climate conferences or political meetings or decision-making spaces talking about magic or intuition or our relationships with the dead, or taking anyone who brings these invitations up seriously. So what would you like to share in regards to how we talk about things that are difficult to conceptualize and intellectualize because they do exist more so in intuitive and spiritual realms that we don't even fully understand ourselves? Like you said, I don't know. And that might be embodied differently by different people as well. And that also may not be able to be fully put into words.
Part of the great I don't know, the great mystery, is I also don't have to be in charge. And I know I'm not in charge. I don't want to be in charge. You know, there's a saying in 12-step groups that, you know, our best thinking got us here, which was, i.e., addicted and hopeless. And our best thinking has brought us to a world on the brink of extinction. And I sometimes think that the entire natural world, the plants, the animals, all the other beings that are, look at us and go, stop. For Christ's sake, just stop. Stop everything. And I think we are going to be stopped. And, you know, I pray we are. I align with them. I often ask people, what are you praying for? Are you praying to reform and fix this ecocidal catastrophe? Or are we praying for it to collapse? Because that may not look like we imagine it looks. Sometimes you pray for healing and you get very, very sick indeed. And sometimes you have to know that life isn't a straight line. It's a great circle. And those circles are regenerative and merciful. But sometimes the short story looks very different than we imagine. I don't think any policy is going to prepare us for what's coming. And I do think there are marvelous people doing marvelous things and collaborating with the natural world in ways that are surprising and beautiful. But I really pray that we get set right. And I think we will very soon. I think there are forces much bigger than us underway. And we need to be a lot more humble. I mean, I don't see civilization stopping of its own accord. I mean, I think I want to collaborate where I am with the natural world and know and be ready for, I think, enormous changes are coming, much, much bigger than we know.
Yeah, and it seems like they're coming whether or not people facilitate that transformation process. And yeah.
I talk about learning to ask for help from the dead. But I learned to ask for help from the dead when my daughter became diagnosed with an incurable genetic disorder. And when you're a parent and you know that the medical system has failed you and there is no hope, then you learn about prayer. And you learn that you can walk through the darkness of a minefield and find your way to small daily miracles that make a difference. You know, I always say, you want to learn how to survive climate change? Go talk to the people who are surviving climate change. They're living in garbage dumps. They're living in refugee camps. And believe me, they believe in magic.
Well, we are coming to a close for our main discussion here, but I would love to hold space for you to share anything else that's presently lingering on your mind that I didn't get to ask you about, as well as your calls to deeper inquiry or sensing for our listeners.
We got very serious here. But I think one of the things that has happened when we begin to collaborate with the unseen world is we also begin to have more fun. I don't think we have a lot of fun anymore. And the dead are tremendously fun. And I think one of the things that will make a difference is pleasure. And to not feel so anxious and not feel so alone and not feel so frightened. I think when people feel free of these tremendous burdens and anxieties they have and this tremendous isolation, you know, the world wants to have fun with us too. It wants us to fall in love. It wants to fall in love. We've forgotten how, you know, the world wants eros. It wants rejuvenation. It wants pleasure. I hope people can know that their mothers and their grandmothers and the trees and their pets are there for them each and every day in very small practical ways. And that that can transform everything to know they're real.
Well, Green Dreamer, we are coming to a close here, but we will have references and resources from this episode linked in our show notes at greendreamer.com. And for now, Perdita, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It's been an absolute pleasure to explore a lot of these topics that definitely should be explored more. For now, though, what final words of wisdom do you have for us as Green Dreamers?
I always like people to find their own wisdom from within. You have more wisdom within you than you know. You've had more lives within you than you know. You've had lives as plants, as animals, as other beings. And each of those lives has collected and composted wisdom within you that you can access when you begin to access your relationship to the other side.
Green Dreamer is a community-powered podcast made possible by listeners like you. To support our work and tune into our extended and bonus episodes, join us today on Patreon at patreon.com/greendreamer. Our production manager and researcher is Anissa Simohali. Our writer and audio editor is Yasmin Danoon. And I'm your host and producer, Kamea Shane. Thank you for tuning in, and we will catch you soon in our next episode. Walking out from
shadow.